So have you ever felt like you were caught in a situation where the odds were completely stacked against you? Like you felt that you were standing on the edge, knowing that something big was about to happen, but you weren't sure how it was going to unfold. You were wondering, how bad is this possibly going to be for me? Or possibly, is this going to turn out okay? In those moments, you might wonder, where is God in this situation? How can I trust that God is working for my good, even though there are moments where we feel like everything in life is unraveling? So today we're picking up our series in Esther chapter 7, where we're finding ourselves ultimately at this dramatic conclusion of the story where everything seems to hinge on a single moment of decision, a moment of truth. Esther is this young Jewish woman who has been elevated to become the queen of a foreign empire, and she now faces this terrifying moment. The life of her people and her own life are all on the line because this villainous Haman, who's second in command of the whole Persian Empire, has been plotting the destruction of all the Jews and of Esther. And so against all odds, it's time for her to finally act. But here's where we found the real power in this story really lies. We've seen it through each and every Sunday. It's not the courage that Esther shows in the moments of this drama. It's how God seems to be continually working behind the scenes. I mean, the story's got twists and turns all over, and God's never mentioned. But what's obvious, if you're reading through a lens of knowing that God cares about his people, is that he's the one orchestrating everything. We see that he's the one who continues to time things with perfection. He's the one whose hidden hand is moving the pieces to all fall into place. He's the one who can turn things around in an instant. What seemed like a hopeless situation, today we see becomes the setting for his great and final salvation for his people. So as you open to Esther 7, watch how God's sovereignty unfolds in the most unexpected ways, and how in the midst maybe of your own challenges, he can still turn the tables and bring about his purposes for you, his children. Now remember, we're about to jump in. Last week, we left on a cliffhanger. Haman knew things looked really, really bad. And in that moment, the king's eunuchs showed up to pick him up and take him off to the second night of a banquet that Queen Esther had prepared for just a guest list of two, the king and Haman. So we're picking up in verse 1. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. And as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom. Last week we said, this is figurative. It's just what King said. It will be granted. Then Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Esther's beginning a very dangerous and delicate dance here because she's got to accuse Haman of this awful and evil edict that he put out that would have all the Jews throughout all of Persia destroyed. But at the same time, she doesn't want to accuse her king, who in reality, by giving his signet ring to Haman to sign the decree, he figuratively, he gave his stamp of approval for this edict. So she's trying to say, okay, this terrible thing Haman did, but no, you're not involved. So she's kind of speaking in passive tones through this. So she's trying to make sure that she turns her husband, the king, against his number two in command and close friend, without bringing the king's wrath down on herself. It's quite the needle for her to thread, so let's see how she does it. First, she connects her own life with that of her people, the Jews. This is the first time. Remember, Mordecai had told her when she was brought into the palace, don't tell people you're Jewish. Don't let them know. So for years, she's been hiding her ethnicity. But now, and she's been fitting into the Persian system. She's been following their customs. They have no idea that she's Jewish. But maybe this sounds a little bit like your life. You're a Christian, but people maybe at your school or at your place of work, they don't know that you're a Christian. Some of you I know wear t-shirts. Everybody knows you're a Christian. There's others of you that are like, I would never wear a t-shirt. Like, I don't wear my faith on my sleeve like that. And I understand, maybe for reasons of feeling like you don't want to just stand out. You're not the type of person to make a really big deal of your faith. But here's the thing. There are moments that you have to make a big deal of your faith. There are moments that you have to stand up and identify with the people that you identify with. There are moments in life where there are challenges, and there's challenges to God's name that you're there. And you could shrink back, and maybe your nature is to shrink back and stay quiet. But like Queen Esther here, you need to learn that it's in those moments you need to boldly stand and say, yeah, I'm a child of God. I'm part of Team Jesus. I'm a Christian. And even though it might cost you something, it might cost you in your reputation, it might cost you in the promotion and the raise, it might actually even bring ridicule down on you by these people who think less of Christians for years to come in the future. And you might know that, but there are times and there are moments of truth where as a follower of Jesus, you do have to stand up and say, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, I follow Jesus. I believe this to be true. We need to talk about this. You can't just talk about Jesus like that. Okay. Then, secondly, what she does is she quotes Haman's decree of what is to be done to the Jews. She directly quotes from his edict that we read in Esther chapter 3, verse 13. The order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. And somehow, even though she's quoting the exact words, King Xerxes is not picking up what she's laying down. Verse 5, King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he? The man who has dared to do such a thing. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, Esther said, an adversary and enemy, this vile Haman. You have to wonder how disconnected King Xerxes is from what's going on all around him. An edict went out that a whole people group in his kingdom is to be wiped out. We saw all the people in Susa were bewildered when they heard of this news. And then when Esther quotes from the edict, he's like, huh, what are you talking about, Esther? I don't understand. Like, he lives in his palace and he doesn't understand at all what's going on around him. But the other thing we notice is he does seem to genuinely care about his queen, Esther. He wants to protect her, even though, yes, this text told us that he hadn't seen her or summoned her for over 30 days. That's a strange marriage to me. I don't understand being married to somebody and not seeing them for 30 days. Up until, you know, this series of events. But he wanted to protect her. I think that's genuinely true. It's possible his motives were more to protect his own reputation, because if something happened to his queen, he would look really, really bad. So perhaps there's a little bit of selfish motivation there. But he realizes this is a big deal. And so this is finally when Esther spills the beans. And she paints this vivid picture of her feelings towards Haman, an adversary and enemy, this vile Haman. Like, this guy, only two of you are dining with me. She's talking with the one and she's pointing at the other. I can't imagine how Haman's feeling in this moment. It's probably getting a little bit hot in there. And that's where this thing goes in verse 6. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. And so first, this is the moment the shoe drops for Haman, and he knows he's done. Second, the king is so mad, he leaves his wine. I find this to be a hilarious detail that the story has to include. Like, clearly, this guy has an issue with alcohol because, and he's so concerned with what's going on, he, for the first time, left the wine behind while he went into the garden to think about what the heck was needed to happen going forward. So what do you think the king is thinking about in this moment? Because the text doesn't tell us. It just tells us he goes off to the garden. It could be that he's wondering, how can I punish Haman for this plot that he's done because I approved it myself by giving him the signet ring? If I do condemn him, does that not make me have to admit my own role in this fiasco? And ultimately, it makes me look really bad. Plus, because it was an irrevocable law, how can the king rescind it? It makes him look weak if he makes a law and he just sends back, just kidding, can't do that. It's a mistake. You know, forget that. It's like when you get an email and then you get another email. It's like, hey, sorry, we sent you the first email. Just delete it. It doesn't apply to you. We think less of people when that happens sometimes, or if a business does that. So the king couldn't do that. Fortunately for him, because of Haman's next massive blunder, he kind of gets out of his pickle. But before we get there, one detail that the text does tell us is that Haman believed his fate had been sealed. But rather than going to the king and begging the king for his life, Haman knew how the king worked. The king never made a decision on his own. He always made the decision that other people told him to make. We've seen that through the whole book. So he doesn't go to the king and beg for his life. Instead, he goes to Queen Esther, thinking, well, if I can get her to say, okay, you're right, he doesn't need to die for what he's done, then maybe the king will allow me to live. Verse 8, just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house? Wow, this is awful timing for Haman. So a bit of context to help you understand what just went on here and why this is so much more absurd than we can even fathom in our own minds. There was a rule that a man was not to approach a woman of the king's harem within 7 steps. No man was ever to be within 7 steps of a woman in the king's harem. And so the king walks in, as he's much closer than 7 steps, he's falling into her lap. And so yet again, we see Haman's timing, that the king walks in to watch this exact action take place. It's absolutely awful for Haman. It's perfect for the king, because now he kind of gets off the hook. Like, does he actually believe that in this moment, Haman was like, great opportunity for me to take sexual advantage of the queen. The king just left and stepped outside. Like, I don't think the king's actually thinking Haman's trying to molest her. But by saying that, he's able to play his cards and be like, look at what he just did. Now I have to take his life. He just violated the queen. And so, like, in this simple moment, the king just kind of spins it and is like, whoa, he's trying to molest my wife. And so, we get to verse 9. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, a pole reaching to a height of 50 cubits, that's 75 feet, stands by Haman's house. He had it set up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king. The king said, impale him on it. So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. So twice now we've seen Haman's timing being unbelievably awful. If you recall, it was last week, there was this moment where he walked into the king, literally about to ask the king to have Mordecai impaled on this giant pole he'd set up at his house. And in the moment he came in to say, I want that guy dead, the king was thinking, how do we honor Mordecai? And it was like this terrible crossing, and Haman was humiliated. But we have the second moment here right now where Haman came in and he had this pole set up for Mordecai, and instead it's getting flipped and he's the one to be impaled on it. It becomes his own instrument of death. And so this is a perfect example for this proverb, Proverb 26:27. It says, whoever digs a pit will fall into it. If someone rolls a stone, it will roll back on them. Learn from that lesson. It would have been even better if the writer of that proverb had said, if someone builds a pole, he will be impaled on it, because that would have fit perfect. But if you're trying to create a trap for somebody else, good luck, right? God works in mysterious ways, and that's going to fall back on your head. So this does bring up one more point I have to explain. Many of you probably have a Bible that calls it a gallows. That's 50 cubits or 75 feet, and that he's hung on it. In fact, even if you have an older NIV translation of the Bible, it called it a gallows and said he was hung. And then in 2011, the NIV revised their translation, and every Bible sold since, says that he's impaled on a pole. So what's going on here? So the Hebrew word that is used in the book of Esther here for gallows actually literally means tree, or possibly pole or stake. And it's believed, because of stone carvings that they've found in Persia, people were not hung by their necks, but they were actually impaled from between their legs and held up for all to see. And so while we, you know, we're more familiar with hanging, that's not what we found out they did in Persia. And so that's why in newer context and some newer translations, they call it what we believe is more likely to have occurred, was that he was truly impaled on a pole and then held way up high, 75 feet, for all the people to see, to bring the greatest level of disgrace to him. Either way, by orchestrating the death of Haman the Agagite, if you recall, Queen Esther finally succeeded where King Saul had failed centuries earlier. Now, before we move to the next chapter, we're going to get into chapter 8. Let's take a moment to evaluate the trajectory of Haman. This is kind of Haman's swan song. We're not going to see him anymore. But consider how the entire conflict between Haman and the Jewish people begins when Mordecai the Jew dishonors Haman the Agagite by refusing to fall down and bow to him. And then in this final scene, Haman falls before a Jew, and even more than that, a Jewish woman. And that literal fall into the queen brought his downfall all the way from his exalted position of second in command of all of Persia to this dishonorable death displayed for all to see. As hopeless of a situation as Haman created for the Jews, God's justice ultimately prevailed. And so this sudden reversal of expected outcomes gives Haman's story a real tragic irony. It demonstrates that apart from God, all of a person's best laid plans can in an instant be flipped upside down. It's all especially ironic when that person, Haman, had the power of this huge empire behind him. And his downfall began ultimately with one night of lousy sleep by the king. Think about that. Everything was going great, and one night the king couldn't sleep. And so they had a chronicle of all of his, everything he'd done read to him, and that was the beginning of the end for Haman. God works in mysterious ways. Finally, there's one other point to be made here. often we like to compare ourselves to the heroes of the story. When we read the Bible, we like to say, well, I'm like David, I'm like Joseph, I need to be a Jacob. In this story, we might be saying, well, how am I like Mordecai or like Esther? And I think a better question, how much Haman is in you? As we've gone through this story, we've seen Haman is a guy who loved his position and his possessions. He loved that everybody had been instructed to bow down to him everywhere he went. He bragged to his family about all of his great wealth. Like, look at me, I am amazing. And I think some of us let pride well up in us. It might not be as overt as Haman has in his life. But where are areas in your life where you are prideful? Where you think, man, can't believe that person thinks that way. What a fool. When you think that, you're saying, look at how smart I am. Can't believe they did that. How stupid. You think you wouldn't do that if you were in their shoes. The other thing we see in Haman is he wanted to control everybody around him. He wanted people to think how he thought, act how he believed they should act. And when there was one man who stood up to him and refused to bow down to him, it drove him nuts. And here's the question for you. How easily frustrated are you when you want somebody to do something your way and they're unwilling to? And this can come down to small things like, why can't my kid load the dishwasher the way he's supposed to load the dishwasher, right? There's all these things. We make ourselves the center of life and we're the perfect ones and everybody else is failing to measure up to us and we want to control them and make them do it exactly how we know is the right way to do it. And Haman is the poster child for this way of thinking. And here's the truth, that's in all of us. And unless we're recognizing it and we're trying to say, God, show me my sin so I can be more like you, we'll go on living this out being like, man, Haman's such a vile, awful villain in this story. And meanwhile, we have so much of those beliefs in our own heart and we don't even see it. So I encourage you this week, take a moment and think about, where do I have Haman's thinking in my own mind? And then pray and ask God to purge that from you, to cleanse you of that pride. It's a nonstop process, but we have to be looking for it or we will never see it. So we get to Esther, chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. The same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. So now in chapter 8, we begin to reach the resolution of this book. And the first thing we learn is that God will give you more than you ever ask for. Notice Esther doesn't ask for any of this. All she wants is salvation for her and her people from this wicked edict. But instead, God destroys the enemy of Mordecai and all the Jews. And then he gives his position and his possessions, the two things Mordecai or Haman loved the most, and God gives those to Mordecai, having never been asked for those things. And now I don't want you to misunderstand me as leaning into the prosperity gospel. This is no guarantee that, hey, if you decide to be a Christian, you're going to be healthy and wealthy, and everything's going to be great. But if you follow Jesus, I do believe along the way, if you keep your eyes open, you will notice little tiny blessings all over your life. You will notice little things, little gifts that God drops in your life, relationships, kind words, little things that just go your way that maybe we are like, oh, it's all coincidence, just like everything in the book of Esther must be coincidence. Or we recognize that maybe God is so good that he's giving you all these little blessings that we've been missing for all these years. And then more than that, when we get to the end of our life, I don't think any of us truly fathom how good eternity is going to be. I think we try to have an idea of what heaven is, but ultimately, even if this life ends on a sour note for you, but you end up in an eternity with God, you're still going to be saying, wow, I can't believe it, God. You gave me more than I ever could have asked for. You have always gone over the top in your gracious, loving, and good hand towards me. So then if you're reading through verse 3 and 6, it tells us about how Esther ultimately, she went and she fell at the king's feet, weeping and pleading for the king to write an order overruling the first edict that was to have the Jews destroyed. And we pick up in verse 7, it says, King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, because Haman attacked the Jews, I've given his estate to Esther, and they've impaled him on the pole he set up. Now write another decree in the king's name in behalf of the Jews as seems best to you. That's what he does. He always gives off authority to others. And seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with this ring can be revoked. So basically he says, look, I already eliminated Haman and I gave his estate to you. So you do whatever you need to do to save your people. He just kind of pushes it off on them. And he gives his full authority by giving them that signet ring. That's the same ring that Haman was able to seal the first decree. And he's saying, write whatever you want and seal it with this same ring. And so the key in the king's answer here, though, is that he's saying he cannot revoke what he's already done. He can't send out that letter that says, never mind. Just kidding. Like I've already said, according to Persian custom, every law was binding to eternity. So if they wanted to fix the situation, they somehow had to write a counter decree. And when I thought about that, there was this really interesting connection that I read in a commentary today. I don't normally quote from commentaries, but I wanted you guys to see this. It said, just as Xerxes, king of Persia, could not simply rescind the first decree of death, God, king of the universe, cannot simply rescind the decree of death pronounced in the Garden of Eden against humanity. Instead, he, God, issued a counter decree of life, the gospel of Jesus Christ, because God did not simply rescind the curse of death on humanity. His counter-decree of redemption necessarily resulted in the incarnation of his son and in that son's death on the cross. I don't know about you, but that made me say, wow, God couldn't rescind his first decree. He's God, and he established a rule and a law. So what he did is he gave a counter-decree of life. He sent his son Jesus to ultimately pay the price of the first decree so that we, by grace, can be saved. That's absolutely incredible. Verse 10, Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by mounted carriers who rode fast horses, especially bred for the king. So we're going to end in the middle of chapter 8 today with this message of salvation being sent out through all the land. The enemy of the Jews has been eliminated, and now this message containing deliverance is in the mail. And while this section in chapter 8 is almost word for word identical to how the decree went out in chapter 3, there's one detail that's added to this verse that I think is so fascinating. It says that the decree went out on mounted carriers who rode fast horses. There's an urgency in this message. This is the message to save the Jews. And so it didn't just go out. It got put on the king's horses. And it needed to go out quickly. It was the message of salvation. It was so important. There was no time to wait. This message contained life, and the people needed to hear it immediately. And I'm sure many of you see what I'm about to say next. We have a message of salvation that needs to go out to our families and our friends and to this community. And we need to understand, we don't just let it trickle out. We need to get the fast horses ready. And we need to send this message out because this world is a dark place. There are a lot of people who are struggling in our community and they don't know anything about Jesus. They don't know anything about grace. They don't know anything about heaven or hell. They just know that their world's a mess and they have no idea how it'll get better. And we have a message that says, but there's hope and there's forgiveness and there's life and there's a book of instruction that can help you live a life that's going to get you out of some of these pits you keep falling into. But we don't just hold up the message and leave it in the palace and hope that people find out about it. We have to take it out. We have to take it from this place. We have to be willing to share it. When we see people in dire situations, we have to recognize we have the good news of salvation and they need to hear it. We've got to stop waiting. We've got to have a little urgency in our convictions here. We've got to identify with our team and say, look, I follow Jesus and it's the best thing for me. And I want you to follow Jesus because it'll change your life. Next week, we're going to wrap up this entire story in Esther and see what Mordecai's decree says and how the Jews are going to escape this death sentence. But today you need to understand the main point from our message is that your life is better when you unite your purpose and will with God's. Haman had his own purpose, his own will, his own desires, and he was going exactly opposite God's way. And what it did is it led to a very abrupt and disgraceful demise. Meanwhile, Esther risked her life to save her people. And she received even more than she asked for. Her request was fully in line with God's will. It was to free her people, to protect the nation of Israel. And God delivered. So today, we're going to end right where I began. What situation are you sitting in where you feel like you're on the edge and you don't know how it's going to go? If that's you, lean into your identity like Esther did. She identified with the Jews. You are a child of God. You have God on your side. Don't forget who you are. And take the steps that are in front of you that line up with God's will for justice and righteousness, and holiness, and grace, and love. It may be risky, and it may take an extra dose of courage, but trust that His timing is always perfect, and that He will provide. Would you bow your heads with me as we pray?